Does your ass smell? Do you want to feel fresh and clean all day long? Of course you do. That's why you need soap. Soap is specifically formulated to gently clean, leaving you feeling refreshed and confident. Washing your ass with soap provides more than just a clean feeling. It helps to maintain good hygiene and can even reduce the risk of skin irritation and infection. Soap, the simple solution for a clean and refreshed ass. Try it today and feel the difference. Soap, available wherever they sell soap.
Kevin, we kind of messed up last week, didn't we?
No, we didn't. We swapped out the wheel and we let Pierce bring in his wheel, this big octagon thing. And because of that, we didn't have a chance to spin the wheel ourselves. So what did we do, Will?
We cheated. We made life easier for ourselves.
Yeah, I said, like, it's going to be your episode. So listen, why don't you pick something that you are a mastermind in? And this will be your specialist topic. And you chose. So this is going to be the most in-depth, detailed podcast we've ever done because you particularly chose this subject. So
I put particular asterisk on this. And we should leave the asterisk right here and get into the intro. Roll the intro.
I'll use small words so that you'll be sure to understand, you warthog-faced buffoon.
What you just said is one of the most insanely idiotic things I have ever heard. Everyone in this room is now dumber for having listened to it.
What did you say?
You are a sad, strange little man.
Don't call me stupid.
Hello, and welcome to The Best Bits, a movie podcast where we pick our favorite scenes from randomly selected, weirdly specific themes. This is your co-host Will, writer of three films plus a Christmas special, and I'm joined, once again, by my co-host and writer of one and a bit films and three and a bit episodes of TV, Kevin.
The name's Lehan. Kevin Lehan.
Keeping in theme. You know what I was going to do start off tonight with Kevin? I was going to go, Bonna is Sanam Dumma. Seamus Bonner.
Oh, for fuck's sake. That took me a second. I was thinking, who the fuck is Seamus?
Seamus Bonner is Adam Dunn.
Yeah.
That's Irish for James Bond. It's my name. I was imagining, have you ever thought about what it would be like if James Bond was Irish?
Yeah, he'd be Pierce Brosnan.
What if he actually claims to be from Irish descent? Like, that's, he didn't have MI5.
Well, he wouldn't be going around the world dominating like a typical imperialist colonialist, that's for sure. He'd be going around like what we've
Irish
got
guys.
Like the UN, the what are they called, the UN forces, the Irish peacekeepers, that's
Irish
what he'd
peacekeepers.
Be like
he'd be just going around bumping into people and says, "No, where are you from? Who are your people? Do I know, are you one of the O'Shea's from outside Taiwan?" that's where we'd be going, Kevin.
"I'm from Cork, where are you from?"
Kevin, if our listeners haven't copped it yet, or maybe even haven't copped by the title, or maybe some of the music that's playing, we tonight
copyrighted music, isn't it? Oh my God!
Already
that's a strike.
striking ourselves off the list. Tonight we are talking about our best James Bond scenes, and I picked this for myself, and I don't know if it is a good thing or a bad thing.
It's
Kevin,
a great thing.
It's
although,
a good thing.
When you picked it, I thought to myself, oh Christ, now I have to rewatch so many Bond movies and for the first time watch 9 of them. I hadn't seen a single one of the 60s Bond movies.
Wow.
So this week I've seen 14 Bond films and the rest I'm going off memory.
14? Jesus.
Yeah. And
I
watched
great.
9 of them for the first time. So listen, I am shaken and definitely stirred.
The reason I picked this topic was not because I am an expert or I'm a devout fan. It's because I watched all the films recently. That's the reason. And so I didn't have to do research. That is the sole reason.
I'm surprised you didn't pick Body Swap again. That would have been easy. Just watch all the Body Swap movies.
Just watch them all again. That'd be great crack.
Yeah. Daniel Craig, when he was promoting Skyfall, he was on Graham Norton's chat show.
Right.
And he said that here is how you get your Bond girl name.
Yeah.
And it's very simple. He said, there's a certain formula to it. You take the name that you called your private parts when you were a kid and your grandmother's maiden name. So do you want to know what mine is?
Yes, please.
It's Beast Cockburn. No, it's not. It's actually a really good one, though. And I swear to you, this is genuine. It's Willie Hyde.
Yes. Do you want to know what mine is?
Go for it.
Mickey Flynn.
That's definitely one of the Irish henchmen.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
Mickey Flynn.
And Willie Hyde.
I could just see him. Oh, my God. We can start our spin-off franchise, Kevin. I think this is it.
That's just what we need. Well, more podcasts.
That's what the world needs.
Who were those two weirdos in Diamonds Are Forever? Winton and yeah. Mr. Kid or something?
Yeah.
That's us. Willie and Mickey.
Kevin. We've got a lot of Bond to cover, and we've got a little bit of time, right?
Take so we, time, we'll be here all night.
We're going to be here all night. This, I don't intend this to be a 3-hour podcast, so I needed to find a way to get into it. First of all, I have to tell you, Kevin, that we are talking about a film franchise which is one of the highest grossing film franchise in cinema history. Over the course of 25 films, which started back in 1962, the franchise has grossed over $7 billion at the box office alone. It's had 13 directors at the helm. It's had smash hit theme songs. Bond has been brought to life by 6 actors who've officially played the character. And so I have a gargantuan topic to try and condense in this podcast. And I said, how the fuck am I going to do this in the easiest possible way? And I said, I got it. I'm going to do the bargain basement way of doing this. I'm going to rank my Bonds.
You're going to do what to them?
I'm ranking my Bonds.
Oh, rank. Oh, thank God. I don't know, Will. I've just been listening to puns all week. I can't say things like that to me.
That's fair enough. That's fair enough. So what I am going to do, Kevin, is I am taking my least favorite Bond up to my favorite Bond, and I'm going to pick one scene from each Bond's tenure. And that's going to be how I do it. And maybe we can talk about each of the Bonds that way and maybe kind of like vaguely have a conversation about the Bond films. How does that sound to you?
Vaguely sounds good to me.
Vague is my middle name.
Mine's Cockburn.
We lost it. You know what? I've had a very conflicted relationship with Bond, right? On the surface, I shouldn't like Bond.
Because he's English. Do you know we have more listeners in England than we do in Ireland, Will?
I know. It's not that he's English. It's that he's like a rich kind of like jockey school bully who's gets all the girls and doesn't study for exams, but still comes out with like top marks.
Just like Harry Potter.
Just like Harry Potter. You get what I'm saying? There's a kind of a cringiness kind of like being with him, but also I just can't help but enjoy being in his company because he gets to go cool places and do cool things. And he's a super spy. And I like living in his shadow for 2 and a bit hours. What about yourself?
See, okay, when you said let's do Bond, I realized that I hadn't properly seen all of the Sean Connery films. In fact, I'd only seen, and this is appalling, I'd only seen Never Say Never Again.
What?
So I had never seen any of his...
So you'd seen none of his official films?
None. I'd seen chunks of them.
Unofficial one.
But when I was growing up, right, the Bond movies that were always on the telly were the Roger Moore ones.
That's true. That's true.
And the ones I was old enough to see were the Pierce Brosnan films. Tomorrow Never Dies was the very first Bond film that I saw in the cinema, and I've seen every one since then. Mm-hmm. But I had sort of like seen snippets of all the different entries from Sean Connery, and I hadn't really had a good reason to go back to see them. You know, you'd have to buy the box sets, and I never did that to sort of explore those films. So this week, I had a great excuse to go back to see the films that I had missed. And I don't know, I didn't come away from it feeling put at a distance because Sean Connery was the Bond that I was watching the most this week. And I know they call him English. He just doesn't have an English spirit about him. He doesn't come across like an English colonialist. There's much more of a Celtic sort of alpha male vibe to him. And so I just really fucking loved this week watching these films.
I'm delighted. I'm delighted. And I get exactly what you're saying. There's something different about Connery's Bond to even his surrounding characters who actually are proper British people. But I think I'm going to wait to contribute my opinions on Sean Connery until maybe further up my list. Okay. Because
spoiler alert.
My least favorite. So I'm going to start with my Bonds. I'm going to talk about my least favorite Bond first, which is Sean Connery. So let's just continue the conversation, Kevin.
Seriously?
No, I'm joking. Oh. I'm joking, of course. So I'm going
to... I know who it's going to be. It's going to be George Lazenby, isn't it?
Good morning. My name's Bond. James Bond.
Yeah, and obviously in sixth place for me was poor George Lazenby, who got just one film in the role, 1969's On Her Majesty's Secret Service.
Okay, so this was one of the films that I watched for the first time for this podcast.
Yeah.
I had heard that this was one of the best ones in the whole franchise.
Same, yes.
And maybe it's gotten that sort of like Halloween 3 sort of recontextualization where people are now starting to look back at it and think that was the odd one out, but it's actually one of the better ones. Personally, I thought it was quite slow and I thought it really lacked Connery's character. Mm. The way that he played Bond, I couldn't imagine Connery in On Her Majesty's Secret Service because of what George Lazenby has to do in it. I just don't think it would suit Connery.
Yeah.
So therefore, I think they would have changed it to suit his persona and his type of Bond. And I think the film would have benefited from that because some of the undercover sort of baronet stuff, the flounciness,
it's so odd. It became for me in a section a 60s sex comedy, and it felt so, him putting on an accent, him pretending to be this baron, and it felt so, as you said, weird and out of place.
He's not a bad actor though. That was one thing that I was surprised about. He's actually, you know, quite capable and quite good in the role. He's just very anonymous.
What I loved about him and his portrayal and what he brought to the role was his physicality. Because he fucking really, I think he did nearly all the stunts himself. Not everything, but he did a fair amount of the stunts himself. He kind of insisted upon it because he was this kind of...
What stunts? There wasn't hardly any in it.
What stunts? All the physical fighting and stuff like that. Well, Connery wouldn't do all that fighting. Like, he was climbing on things and, you know, in long shots where Connery would have had a body double, it was Lazenby doing all the long shot stuff. You can definitely tell.
I also thought Telly Savalas was a very odd choice for Blofeld.
He was a poor replacement for Donald Pleasence, in my opinion. I loved Donald Pleasence, but it was a different kind of interpretation of the Blofeld character. He was a much more kind of suave, kind of like, you could imagine him, you know, you could imagine Telly Savalas seducing all these beautiful women to his Alpine mansion.
Do you know who he reminded me of, Will?
Who did he remind you of?
Or who he could have been?
Yeah.
What film do I always talk about?
Jaws. No,
Superman. He would have been a perfect Lex Luthor in Superman the movie.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Yeah, absolutely right.
I thought Diana Rigg though was an excellent Bond girl.
Yeah,
and when you're sort of ranking the Bond girls,
mm-hmm.
I would put her very, very high on the placement.
Absolutely, she was one of the delights of this film. I totally understand why Bond fell in love with her. I thought she was so charming and so effervescent and beautiful, but there was just this lovely...
And complicated.
Yeah, there was a lovely... Yeah, there was a, her character had a lovely backstory and you understand where she... But ultimately, I picked one scene from this film that I thought was my favourite scene. And I think it's kind of an obvious pick. If you had to pick one scene from On Her Majesty's Secret Service, what would it be?
I think it would be the ski slope action sequence.
Oh, right. You see, I wasn't going that
way. I loved the way that was cut together, the sort of the ominous cutting between. I'll tell you the things I really loved about On a Majesty's Secret Service. I loved the snowy setting. I loved that it was Christmassy.
Yeah.
And it definitely had a different vibe to it than the other films. It was directed by the editor, wasn't it?
Yeah, Hunt. Yeah, it was Peter Hunt.
His one and only film. Mm-hmm. And I think he brought in some lovely atmosphere.
He was a second unit director on some of the previous films as well.
But he brought in some great atmosphere. So there's moments in that where you've got Bond fighting the goons who are pursuing him on the skis and they're cross-cutting between the town below and the Christmassy vibes. And I thought I had great style and great atmosphere, but I'm not sure what your favourite scene would be if it's not that.
My favourite scene is the kind of the one scene that really stands apart from all the other Bonds that preceded it and then most after it. It's the final scene, the scene where, you know, they get married and he pulls over to the side. Yeah. And Blofeld and whatever his hench lady is called guns them down.
Anyway, you have given me a wedding present. The best I could have. The future.
Mrs. Bond, shut up And don't eat it all at once.
He loves me.
Instinctively.
Infuriatingly.
Intensely. Indubitably.
First a boy and then a girl.
It's Blofeld. It's Blofeld.
It's all right. It's quite all right, really. She's having a rest. We'll be going on soon. There's no hurry, you see. We have all the time in the world.
I think Lazenby's performance in that is lovely, just his delivery of that line. It's so sweet.
I have a theory, Will.
Go on, what's your theory?
It's that Moneypenny, who has been infatuated and very sweetly in love with Bond through all of the films, she's at the wedding and she's crying. And immediately after, I think he winks at her or something.
Yeah.
And he drives off. Diana Reid gets gunned down. And I think Moneypenny was in on it.
I've tried everything else.
I think there's a scene missing there where she... She sort of slipped information about Bond's movements, and Telly Savalas thought, "Who loves you, baby?" Yeah, I think that's a deleted scene, though.
Brilliant. But you know what? One of the aspects of the film that I really, really love, I love the score and I love the theme song, and those are the music to the Bond series is so integral. The theme tune is one of the only theme tunes which doesn't have lyrics. The sound of John Barry really does contribute so much to the feel of a Bond film. He is absolutely so important. Now, of course, you've got the iconic Bond theme tune, which Monty Norman's the credited writer behind that. But John... It's fantastic. Just like Kevin singing. There you go.
It's brilliant.
So I think I have to, for this film, I have to really call out and champion the music and the score. And I actually really love that about this film.
I want to champion Peter Hunt. Is it Peter Hunt?
Peter Hunt, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He did a great job, and I think he probably took some of the brunt of the dissatisfaction with George Lazenby stepping in for Connery, because Connery fell out with Cubby Broccoli, didn't he? And that's why he decided not to come back.
Yeah, it was a very acrimonious... Connery was difficult. He was becoming a huge star.
He fucked it, because that would have been such a lovely capper to his storyline.
Mm-hmm. And they even, at the end of the previous film, you see, when they went in to shoot You Only Live Twice, he announced, as he was flying over to set, he announced that that was his last Bond. And it was just like, what? Because they wanted this to be his last Bond. But anyway, it was basically, there was a whole load of complications. But they were supposed to shoot On Your Majesty's Secret Service a couple of years beforehand. But anyway, I shall move on to the next fifth pick, or second bottom from the list of favorite Bonds.
You definitely know how to complicate things.
I certainly do. I've always been like that, Kevin. You know, my mother said that to me.
Your fifth place Bond. Go for it.
My mother used to say that to me. She says, well, why are you trying to brush your teeth through your ears? Like, you know, Jesus Christ, man.
That's a good saying, actually.
Just coined it right now. My next least favorite Bond is poor old Irish-born Pierce Brosnan.
The name's Bond. James Bond.
I understand that. I think that Brosnan is a brilliant Bond with the shittest run of films.
Yeah, and I think that's what happened. I know you have a different opinion to me. I felt he started off, his tenure started off great with a really fun Bond film. But after that, they got worse and worse, like exponentially so, I felt, all the way right down to Die Another Day. It's such a shame.
I think Tomorrow Never Dies is better than GoldenEye, to be honest.
Tomorrow Never Dies? Really?
Yeah. Michelle Yeoh. Terry Hatcher. I know Xena Onatopp in GoldenEye is a great Bond gal villain, but the techno music in GoldenEye, ugh, blah, blah.
David Arnold's score. Yeah, David Arnold's. This is where we miss John Barry. We really
definitely
miss David Arnold.
It felt tacky.
Yeah, it did not feel good. And a lot of those films felt, they just felt late 90s kind of cheaper late 90s action. That's what they felt like.
That was really early in the 90s, wasn't it? 92 or
something?
No,
GoldenEye was 95. Then was it Tomorrow Never Dies was 97 and then 99. And then there was a 3-year gap to the next from 2002, Die Another Day. It was such a shame. I could feel in the cinema the kind of cheapness.
Expensive, but cheap looking.
But listen to this. You brought up Tomorrow Never Dies.
Yeah.
Tomorrow Never Dies is the first film with a budget over $100 million that was completely financed by product placement. Can you believe that?
Wow.
Watch the film and you'll see it everywhere. Everywhere. Yeah. There's moments in that film where the film actually stops and you think Bond
wears three watches in that film on both wrists.
And he's got like a cap opener that opens a bottle of Heineken. And he literally has like, you know, that car rental service. Like Q shows up.
Hertz.
Yeah. Is it Hertz? Is it? I can't remember.
I don't know.
Is it Avis or something like that? And Q actually shows up as a rep. He's doing a side job working for them. It's really ridiculous.
And then that whole finale takes place in Tesco. Unbelievable.
But I wanted to point out, so GoldenEye is obviously my favorite film from that series. My favorite sequence and scene from Pierce Brosnan's entire tenure is his very first sequence where we see his Bond bungee jumping off the side of a huge bloody dam, going in, infiltrating this Soviet base with his best buddy, Sean Bean's 006.
Ни одного вздоха. Где ваши?
I'm alone. Aren't we all? You're late, 007. I had to stop in the bathroom. Ready to save the world again? After you, 006.
I love the tension of that entire sequence, which culminates with this amazing action set piece where he has to escape on he's to catch an airplane that's about to fall off the edge of the dam by motorbike, skydives and catches up the plane as it's free falling down and controls the plane. And then we go to the gunshot barrel opener. I think that entire sequence is so wonderfully shot and edited and paced that I was genuinely thrilled and hopeful and excited.
Did you see that in the cinema?
Yeah. Yeah, it was cracker in the cinema. Absolute cracker in the cinema.
I was too young to see that, I think.
Oh, yeah, you might have been just a year or two. It was 95. But you know what it highlighted to me, Kevin, was another...
Prologues.
Prologues are so important in these films. Absolutely. And oftentimes they're so much better. But the stunts, man. The stunts are so important. And when the stunts are done for real, it just, oh God.
Yeah.
They're cracker. Like, you know, it gives you that sense of excitement when you see an actor do it for real
totally.
On camera.
I feel the same way about sex scenes.
not just these digital stand-ins like Avatar.
I just love watching
yeah.
it do it.
Yeah.
No, but you're absolutely right. And that's where the Pierce Brosnan films just fall down towards the end. Oh,
yeah.
God. I fell asleep in the cinema during The World Is Not Enough. I fell asleep during that. And then I remember just my jaw just being like hung open throughout pretty much all of Die Another Day. And just the atrocious sort of CG stunts with him windsurfing on a tsunami and fucking hell, and a plane crash at the end where the plane is like falling for about 15 minutes, and it was just so sort of like weightless and dumb.
It's in complete contradiction to what's preceded it, the decades of amazing stunts that were captured and the teams that were put together to actually do the jobs. And like all the other Bond films, they were a traveling family, really. They were making a film every couple of years. They're always coming back together. Whenever you see skydiving in a Bond film, they were the same guys throughout every film. And I think in the Craig era, you see like amazing stunts coming back, practical stunts coming back in. And that just gives us as an audience this visceral experience where we see, you know, they're doing captured on camera. And even if it's just a stunt performer, it doesn't matter. It takes your breath away.
Yeah. I mean, that was what they hung their hat on for many of the earlier films with the skydiving and the, you know, the Union Jack flag opening up and what have you.
But yeah.
Yeah, no, it's true. It's just that the Bond films in the Brosnan era, they felt tacky.
There's a really weird, you know, the oddity about the casting of the different Bonds. Do you know this bit of trivia that the person who was first, you know, when they were first trying to cast Bond, they approached all of the main Hollywood players at the time, like Clint Eastwood.
Who turned it down? They turned it down because it said Bond should be a Brit.
Yeah, Clint Eastwood. I believe they approached Burt Reynolds as well, but it feels like he would have
been. Yeah, they did. They also went after Roger Moore.
And
they couldn't get him because he was doing The Saint.
There's a repetition of that. So Roger Moore was was approached before Sean Connery, and he turned it down. And then when it was time to cast after Sean Connery, they approached Timothy Dalton first.
Yeah, but he was too young.
He was too young, and he turned it down. So they went back to Roger Moore.
But think about that. It would have been just after The Lion in Winter. So he's in his early 20s.
Yeah.
I suspect that the next Bond is going to be the youngest Bond we've ever had.
I agree with you. But if you continue that trend, so when Roger Moore was handing over the baton, they had cast Pierce Brosnan because he was famous on TV. And he was all set to do it. Like he was all ready to go. And the weekend before they were going to shoot.
They Tom Selleck'd him, didn't they?
They Tom Selleck'd him. Because, it was his producer, the producer of Remington Steele.
Remington Steele, yeah.
Remington Steele fucked him over and says, no, we're going to renew your option for another TV series, for another show. So they cast Timothy Dalton, who is my next pick, Kevin. Timothy Dalton is my next Bond. They cast him over a weekend. So he showed up. He was cast on a Friday and he showed up on a Sunday and was shooting on Monday for The Living Daylights.
Seriously, it was that late?
It was that late. Isn't it incredible?
Pierce Brosnan in like The Living Daylights would have been amazing.
Yeah. But on saying that, my next guy is Timothy Dalton.
Bond, James Bond.
Each Bond brought a different vibe.
Yeah.
So Connery was really serious and hard-edged and not serious, but he was kind of just... He was a tough guy, right?
Yeah, he was an enforcer type.
Roger Moore came in. He was much more of a gentleman and
proper as well. As I said, he felt like a naval officer.
Yeah. And when we get Dalton, we get this more serious, cold, calculating, almost.
But also very sensitive. He's a lot more sensitive than the other Bonds.
He certainly is. You see him really getting involved with his leading lady, and he's not going around riding all around him, which is gas.
There weren't any sheep around.
I think the
He's
living
Welsh. I'm sorry.
Have you? You've obviously seen both The Living Daylights and License to Kill.
Yeah, I did. I saw The Living Daylights as a kid. My dad came back from the pub with a pirated copy of The Living Daylights.
Wow!
And sat down and watched it and had like chips and what have you and thought this is a very different Bond to Roger Moore. It was a lot more violent and intense, and it felt more like an action film that was trying to keep up with like the Stallones, the Rambos, and the sort of the Commandos of the mid-80s. It just felt more bloody.
Yeah, there was an edge to it, a dark image, a more sinister edge, and you see that even from the very first opening.
Did they kill Felix Leiter in the
License to Kill? Yeah, they killed Felix Leiter brutally. Yeah.
Maybe that's the one I saw. Sorry, that was the first one I saw.
Yeah, that one was a troubled production, massively troubled production. They shot that in a part of Mexico. A lot of their action sequences happened on the stretching road. You know, when you see the big truck doing a wheelie.
Yeah, that's a great sequence.
Apparently that stretcher road is cursed and people died on the set. And there was
it's like the road to Dublin. It was cursed.
I wouldn't disagree with you there.
From all directions, it's cursed.
But I think The Living Daylights was the one Bond film that I saw more than any other growing up because it was the tape I had. It was on TV. I think I might have recorded it off TV.
Did you give it to my dad then?
I probably did, yeah. He paid double as well, which was, you know.
50 pence back then.
He gave me 2 pints.
That's right.
Two pints of harp.
Double fisted it.
Fair play to him. But I really liked Timothy Dalton's interpretation of Bond. I thought I revisited a lot of The Living Daylights.
He's a bit dry though. He doesn't have any sense of humor.
Yeah, the sense of humor. And he can't really deliver the one-liners that are in the script. It doesn't fit with his character. Not that he can't. It doesn't fit with his interpretation of the character. It feels like he's just kind of doing it. But what I liked about The Living Daylights is that it kind of went back to the espionage type of story.
Yeah.
Where
it didn't have any of the fucking slide whistle crap of the Roger Moore films.
Yeah. See, that's what happened in the Roger. They started to get so goofy.
Isn't there a scene in Octopussy where he's swinging and they play Tarzan cry?
Yeah.
I thought, what? This is Austin Powers territory. What are you doing, lads?
Yeah, that's kind of what started to happen, the old Roger Moore era at the end of it. And I
won't blame Roger Moore for that, though, because having just watched all of them in sequence, that stuff creeps in Diamonds Are Forever. The sort of the pastiche stuff starts to slip in there, where there's goofy jokes that just feel really out of place when Connery is sort of put into a casket and sent into the crematorium to be burned up.
Mm-hmm.
And they do a jump cut to an old guy that's like berating him for giving him fake diamonds. I thought, what? This is too goofy. But anyway, I was glad that they got back to a seriousness with Timothy Dalton.
Yeah. And do you know what I found, not weird, but curious, is that like most of those Bonds made in the 80s, like that's including Roger Moore and Timothy Dalton's, were all directed by John Glenn. Again, he graduated through the school of the Eon Productions to become a director. So he made a lot of those goofy Roger Moore films and then went on to make this really kind of serious, more espionage, thriller-focused Bond with Timothy Dalton. So I kind of find it interesting how he changed tone so much, you know, or he was allowed to change tone so much for that film.
I remember, as you're saying that, just on the visual aesthetic, how it changed. Like all of the Sean Connery ones, they're shot in like CinemaScope.
Mm-hmm.
They're just gorgeous. They're so wide and great set design and what have you. I noticed it in The Man with the Golden Gun, where the aspect ratio changed and it was like Super 35 or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And it started to look a little TV-like.
It felt like they were cutting on budgets.
It just wasn't this big, wide, you know, expansive frame anymore. It didn't look epic. It looked sort of a little pedestrian.
They were working with the top people.
And that was John Glenn, wasn't it? No, sorry, that was Guy Hamilton.
Sure. But it's about the cinematographer, Kevin. Because I'll be going back to the cinematographer later on, because who they had for those first films, they had top class people working on the first six in particular. Really, really top class people behind and score and cinematography.
People who've been knighted.
Yeah, that sort of stuff. And won Oscars for their work. But now that I was bringing up Timothy Dalton, I was saying, okay, what's my favorite scene from Timothy Dalton's tenure? And I'm going to pick The Living Daylights. And I was thinking, what is my favorite scene from The Living Daylights? So I kind of like quickly jumped through the film. And the scene that I enjoyed the most was the scene with his Austin Martin Volante. The scene where he's escaping the Soviet or the Eastern Bloc police cars. And he's got an Austin Martin car that's got all the gadgets, and he's got a rocket launcher and skis. And he's, you know, it's, I just went, oh, this is a cool car. And Timothy Dalton looked really cool driving it. And all the things it did was cool to me back then. And I watched the thing and went, oh, that looks so class.
What is this?
I've had a few optional extras installed. This modern safety glass.
Look out!
Really? Yeah, the car porn is big on the Bond films.
And the, like, going back to, like, you know, obviously Connery's, you know, Austin Martin from the early films and...
Although I was saying to you earlier before we came on mic that it was really undignified to see Sean Connery on a trike, like racing around the sand dunes. I thought, what have they done to this man?
Yes. Although I did enjoy in some films where they, you know, for a gag, throw Bond into a kind of really shitty Citroen or something like that. And still see how he kind of overcomes the bad guys. Or in Octopussy, he's on one of those... What are those Tic Tacs or whatever they're called? You know, those little kind of like taxi. Rickshaws. Yeah. And then he's still.
Tic
Tac. I can't remember what it was called. Is that one of the Bond villains, Henchman's Tic Tac? I'm afraid it actually might be.
Knick Knack.
Knick Knack. That's him. He was great, actually. But yeah, so like it's got cool gadgets in that film. I like it. I like Timothy Dalton's interpretation. And I feel Timothy Dalton should have gotten that third outing.
Why did they get rid of him? Did he want out himself?
No, he was going to do it. It was a rights mess up.
Oh yeah, that's right. Because this wasn't it the longest break between
Brosnan
and Dalton.
Yeah, it was like 6 years. It was 5 to 6 years. And they had a script written called. It was called At the Request of a Lady, which was based on one of Ian Fleming's.
That's a nice title.
Yeah, it was one of Ian Fleming's Bond stories, short stories. He was going to do it. Not until the very end, very close to the end, where Dalton felt that he was too old at that stage. So he volunteered to step away.
My God. Did he watch any of the Roger Moore films? Roger Moore said in one interview, I remember watching him once, saying that he decided it was time to go when a critic had said that for Roger Moore, getting out of a chair is a stunt.
I love it. You know what I appreciate about Roger Moore in the later films is that he definitely is aware that he's a bit too old to be bedding the ladies. So when the younger girls go at him, it's all in a...
at the younger women.
They're coming at him. It's more of that he's not pursuing them. He's kind of going, oh.
Fuck's sake, in all the films, I was starting to think it was a... You can really tell that Fleming was like getting his rocks off to these stories because the women they basically say hello with their legs behind their ears. It's like unreal.
It feels like.
But I loved Roger Moore, and I know what you mean. He was in on the joke.
He was in on it, and he seemed to be a gentleman. He seemed to be a very nice individual.
And himself, I'll tell you one, you might not know this fact, but what? I was sort of like looking up just so that if there's any sort of things I can mention.
Yeah.
That when it came to Octopussy, Roger Moore's contract had run out. So he was a free agent. And Sean Connery obviously had stepped away at that point. Mm-hmm. And the producers had spoken to both of them about coming back for Octopussy.
Right.
And the other producer who splintered off from them, whose name I can't remember now. Was it Saltzman or somebody else?
Well, Saltzman had gone off and they'd parted ways. All right. So I can't remember who the other guy was.
Never Say Never Again. They had two scripts in front of them and they offered them to both actors. Roger Moore and Sean Connery were offered both films. And they got together themselves and they had a meeting, and Roger said to Sean, which one do you want to play? And he said, well, I'm not working with Cubby. So he took Never Say Never Again and Roger took Octopussy. They both got paid an awful lot of money to come back. And they sort of like, they were in on it themselves. They were playing everybody else off against each other. And it became the Battle of the Bonds that year.
Did both Bonds come out the same day? I have a feeling that...
I don't know if they came out the same day. They definitely came out the same year.
Yeah.
And I was surprised that Never Say Never Again did so well.
Did it? I actually didn't look at the stats for that.
Yeah, it was a pretty... Also, the budget on that was huge. You don't see any of that on screen, I don't think. It feels like the ropiest of the Bond
films. It's going into Sean Connery's pocket. That's where the budget's going.
But I think there's not much in it. It's like one of them made 160 million at the US box office. The other one made like 148 million.
Wow.
So it was, people were into it.
Wow. Oh, wow. That's fascinating.
But yeah, they were pals, Roger Moore and Sean Connery.
The Cubby Broccoli was playing games at the time as well, because he went about recasting Bond. He did a screen test and had Josh Brolin's dad. What's his first name? He was in a...
Josh Brolin.
Josh Brolin's dad. What's Josh Brolin's dad's name called?
Oh no, Josh Brolin's dad is James Brolin.
James Brolin. He did several screen tests with James Brolin and made sure that Roger knew that we're screen testing someone else for the part.
Didn't they do something similar with Tobey Maguire and Jake Gyllenhaal in Spider-Man 2?
Did they?
Yeah. They cast Jake Gyllenhaal. Because Tobey Maguire was holding it for more money.
Oh, wow. I didn't know about that. Wow.
And then he said, no, it's okay. I'll do it.
Yeah, whatever. That brings me on, Kevin, to my third favorite Bond. And it's the most recent Bond, Daniel Craig.
The name's Bond. James Bond.
Ooh, okay. Mm. Yeah.
Well, I like Daniel Craig. I don't know how you... And I like Daniel Craig's iteration of Bond. We had, before Daniel Craig, we had Pierce Brosnan, which got a little bit more Roger Moore-y. And Daniel Craig comes in, and Daniel Craig's Bond, he gets the shit kicked out of
James Blond.
I feel what I enjoy about Daniel Craig's Bond is that he gets...
It's the way he purses his lips.
No, it's the way...
He gives the blue steel. Bond.
It's the way he gets the shit kicked out of him in every film. We have never seen Bond.
I'll tell you what, hammered. I remember seeing Casino Royale in the cinema and feeling genuinely uncomfortable. And first of all, it took me a second to figure out what the fuck is going on here when Bond is naked, tied to a chair with the seat taken out of it.
Yeah.
And he's swinging a
like a waist. Like,
yeah, it's like a, I don't know what you call it. It's like a rope-a-dope type thing.
Yeah.
And now he's battering his balls with it.
Yeah.
I thought, this is hardcore.
Yeah.
That is really hardcore.
We had never seen anything like that. It was taking that GoldenEye scene where the laser's coming up between Connery's legs. It just is as if the laser was actually separating his testicles and actually cutting through his scrotum. I think that's the only way we could have had something to compare to the battering that Daniel Craig experienced in those films. I think Craig has been great in the role, and I have enjoyed his tenure because they've done something. They've created an arc with his character. They could have ended it after the third film, and I think maybe they should have ended it after the third film, but I still enjoyed, you know, the most recent one. I know you have a different opinion. What's your feeling on Craig?
I think that Craig, he had great scripts. He had excellent Bond girls. He had the best looking and the best written Bond girls of the whole franchise, I think.
Mm-hmm.
He had two absolute bangers, two brilliant, brilliant films, like great action films, but also great Bond films.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he came out of it quite well.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, they had to do what they did with Bond after the Bourne franchise came along and sort of like showed up how out of touch and sort of how cheesy the Bond franchise had gotten with Die Another Day.
Mm-hmm.
So I really I've seen all of the Craig films in the summer. I've seen all of them since Tomorrow Never Dies, but they all looked really promising. The only one that really let me down was Quantum of Solace. And I understand why that came about, because of the writer's strike and them not having an actual script and not being able to change anything that was written before the strike came into effect. So they were sort of like hampered by that.
Mm. And I agree with you. I would include the No Time to Die. I thought that was very entertaining as well. But for other reasons, what I really loved about the Craig's era is that, yeah, we actually had a bit of a character arc, which was great. But what I loved was the physicality.
See, I didn't like that.
That's fine. It's okay to not like
it. So this is the thing. This is what I wanted to say to you. Do you think that it's better for Bond to be standalone or sequelized? Because I thought that they tied themselves in knots too much with the Craig era, where they all became sequels, apart from my personal favorite of the Bond films from Craig, which is Skyfall, which feels very standalone.
Yeah. I personally think, to answer your question, I think they're definitely better standalone. I think.
Okay, good.
I definitely think. I love that. Why I appreciate what they've done with Craig's era is they've done something a little bit different. They've kind of experimented with something, and that experiment is closed now. That's finished. No, let's go back.
And never ever do it again.
And let's do our standalone Bond films.
I don't want to see Bond on his knees begging Rami Malek to not hurt his mute French.
I'm going to, oh my God, I thought
this is not Bond. What is this character? And then his child bride.
Yes.
Just like.
Should have been Monica Bellucci from the previous
film. Should have been Monica Bellucci.
Yeah.
It absolutely should have. They should have switched those characters.
Yeah.
He should have gone off with a woman his own age. It would have added so much more gravitas to that. And then I would have been totally on board with it. It would have felt really beautiful and sort of like Bond has grown up.
You don't believe it, do you? You don't believe that relationship.
No, they had no chemistry. And she just looks like a pouty teenage girl where it's like, what is he doing to this? He's wrecking her life. Leave her alone. And I just thought it was so convoluted. Anyway, I'm not going to shit on your favorite Bond film, which is No Time to Die.
No, my favorite. Well, I'm the same. I'm kind of split between Casino Royale and Skyfall, but I'm going to pick my favorite scene from Daniel Craig's films. And my favorite scene from Daniel Craig's films is,
I know it has to be that scene. It's got to be the train sequence with Eva Green.
No, I'm not picking that scene because there's so many scenes. The one I'm going for is the one that gave me the most visceral
podcast.
The most visceral reaction in the cinema. And it's when he's poisoned in the middle of the card game, and he knows he's been poisoned, and he's like, and he immediately reacts. In the one thing that's amazing, what's cool about James Bond's character is that he's always cool under pressure, right? He is always cool under pressure. So he immediately stumbles from his table. He grabs a glass, some salt shaker, goes to the bathroom, fills the salt shaker into the glass, tries to puke. Then we see him staggering across the road outside the street. He gets hit by a car, goes into his own car, calls HQ.
A Citroen.
A third-hand Citroen. That's not past NCT. And he has to defibrillate himself.
Who is it?
007. Bond's been poisoned. He's going into cardiac arrest.
Stay calm.
And don't interrupt, because you'll be dead within 2 minutes unless you do exactly what I tell you.
I'm all ears.
Remove the defibrillator from the pouch.
Do we know what it is yet? I'm still scanning.
Attach the leads to your chest.
Ventricular tachycardia. Digitalis. What the hell do we give him? Okay, that's amphetamine.
As soon as it reads charge, okay, that'll work. Bond.
Don't push the red button.
Yeah, do you hear me? Don't push it yet.
His heart's gonna stop. It's only time for one charge before he passes out.
Take the blue combi pen, Bond. Mid-neck, into the vein.
That'll counteract the digitalis.
You're going to pass out in a few seconds and you need to keep your heart going. Push the red button now, Bond.
Bond, push the damn button.
Do it now.
Yeah, that was class. With M saying just like get on with it.
Just press the button, Bond. Just press the button, and he actually doesn't press the button, and Eva Green saves him at the end. But I love then we have to cut to him returning to the table, and it's like I just defibrillated myself.
It has a very odd structure, that film.
At the end of it, it works. Yeah, but I think it is such an enjoyable film, an enjoyable script, and the action sequences are fantastic.
Do you think that Eva Green is the best Bond girl there's been?
There's been so many good ones. I haven't ranked the Bond girls. Like you just said, Diana Rigg. I love Diana Rigg. There's so many.
See, I think Diana Rigg rivals Eva Green for that. There's both Eva Green and Diana Rigg are very complicated characters. There's a tragedy to both of them, but they have a wit and they're... It feels authentic when they dismiss Bond.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like
Whereas
that.
Whereas in some of the other films, they feel almost like it's just part of the flirtation, that they're just so enamored with him.
I love the scene in Casino Royale where Eva Green and Bond meet for the first time on the train. I love that scene. That's my second
favorite. I love the way she says, perfectly formed arse.
Yeah. Well, it's not as good as how you say it, Kevin, now, in all fairness.
Perfectly formed arse.
So I need to move on to my next number two pick. And
do I get to say my best bit?
Oh, well, yeah. Why not? Why don't you say your best bit? Go on.
It's only because we're at that point where we're talking about Daniel Craig and my best bit. I thought when this topic came up, I thought, well, I'm going to pick something that is representative of the Bond franchise and something that you can only get from a Bond film and not from another action film. You can't get from like a Mission Impossible or whatever, other ones, XXX or Bourne or whatever, that it has to be something that you watch it and you think that is the epitome of Bond. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't really settle on what that is, because do you go with something with gadgets? Do you go something with the Aston Martin? Is it him being flirtatious with like Eva Green or what have you? And in the end, I put myself back in the cinema when I was watching all the Bond films from Tomorrow Never Dies onwards. And I saw Skyfall at the Odeon in Leicester Square with a packed house, you know, an English audience. And the Bond franchise it's an institution within England. It's a great franchise everywhere else, but within England, it is almost like the World Cup for English audiences. They just love that franchise. And, you know, we all love it as well. But for them, it's like, it's their guy up on screen. And it was watching the opening sequence to Skyfall when you meet Bond in media res, and he is on a mission to capture some sort of database that a henchman has gotten off with, and it's got all the names and the aliases of the MI5 and MI6 agents. And he's assisted by Moneypenny. It's the introduction of Moneypenny. We don't know that's who she is yet. You bring back M, Judy Dench. You have this whole team around him. You've got Tanner, and it is a chase sequence that sets up the theme of the movie, which is M stopping at nothing to achieve her objectives and Bond just being a dutiful son. And there are moments in that chase sequence that it was electrifying in the audience, but there's two things that make it sort of perfect Bond to me, and you wouldn't get it anywhere else. And that's where Judy Dench says to Bond, get after him. You realize what happens if he gets away with that. And Bond says, yes, ma'am. And it's in the middle of the chase. And I think there's no one else is going to say something like that in an action sequence. And it typifies Bond being the servant to Her Majesty. And in this sequence, in that film, it's Judy Dench being the queen.
Hannah, which way?
Keep going. I can direct you from here.
You both know what's at stake here. We cannot afford to lose that list.
Yes, ma'am.
And the thing that I remember most vividly about that chase sequence was when Bond is jumping from one of the train carriages onto the next one, and he's hotly pursuing this guy, and the scene just keeps escalating and escalating and escalating, and he's being assisted by Moneypenny, his sort of his greatest fan, and he's been shot at, he's injured, but he's still in pursuit, and he jumps into the train carriage, and when he lands, he fixes his cufflinks. Mm. And I remember just the audience just erupted in claps and cheers. And they just thought, like, that's their guy. That's Bond. No one else is going to do that. He's just so, as you said, cool under pressure. And yeah, that sequence just keeps building and building until you get to the point where Moneypenny has to take the shot. And it's a shot that could kill Bond. And Judy Dench is like, do it. It segues beautifully into the Adele song, which, yeah, I think is one of the great Bond songs.
Absolutely.
And yeah, I just think that sequence for me is the most excited I've been in the cinema watching a Bond film. And I think it's great.
I may have a shot. It's not clean.
Repeat, I do not have a clean shot.
Tunnel ahead. I'm gonna lose them.
Can you get into a better position?
Negative, there's no time.
Take the shot.
I say take the shot.
I can't. I'm aiming at Bond.
Take the bloody shot.
A great time just to briefly mention another staple of the Bond franchise, which is those opening credits, which were done in the early days by Maurice Binder, who did amazing jobs. But it was a great opportunity to have everyone who worked on the film up front, like second unit camera rigger is, you know, and it was just an excuse to get that.
And
song
I think the Skyfall ones are some of the most beautiful and some
class.
Of the best.
Yeah, it really is class. That's a fantastic pick, Kevin. It really is. And it ties nicely into something I want to talk about in my next pick. So my second favorite Bond is, of course, Roger Moore.
Mr. Bond. James Bond.
We've already mentioned so much about Roger Moore. He's charming. He's got a lovable quality about him. He does. Dapper.
I think he gets shit on too much, to be honest.
Too much. But his films are so much fun. But the thing I wanted to highlight about the Roger Moore era, which is the cast of reoccurring characters. You've already mentioned the likes of M.
Lois Maxwell and...
Yeah, Lois Maxwell, who in Moneypenny, he's forever flirtatious, you know, the unrequited love between the two of them. There's that relationship. M is like the headmaster, or as you said, is the mom or the dad in the family. Q is the nerd in the class that he loves to tease. And the likes of Felix Leiter, who's his like buddy out in the fields. But in every film, whenever you're in the safe house with M and Q, there's a familiarity in that scenario. And I think it's so important. It's one of these kind of comforting aspects to a Bond film. Like, you love the Q scenes. I love the Q scenes in the Roger Moore era, because Roger Moore...
That's when they were getting a lot more fun, to be honest.
They were so goofy. They were so goofy, you know. And I think they work really well in the Roger Moore era.
They also work really well in the Brosnan era. Some of the best Q scenes are with Q and Brosnan's Bond.
Now, 007, do please try and return some... Do please try and return some of this equipment in pristine order. Don't touch that. It's my lunch.
When he picks up a Subway sandwich thinking,
what's this?
Is this going to have a bomb in it? It's like, that's my lunch.
See, I feel that's when Brosnan was getting a bit pastiche, because he was getting a bit Roger Moore-y. And it was like, no, Roger Moore did that. You know, as in...
Fuck it. He had to liven up those films somehow.
These guys somehow. What I'm going to pick from the Roger Moore era is...
Okay. This will be good, because there's a lot of Roger Moore.
There's a lot of Roger Moore
stand out.
And I actually was going to go with a Bond and Q moment, because they're all so lovely and fun. And Q, Desmond Llewellyn, played him right up until Tomorrow Never Dies, and tragically died. That wasn't supposed to be his last film, but he tragically died in a car crash before the film came out, like 2 weeks before the film was released.
Yeah, he was speeding on the motorway.
He was, like, absolutely gunning it.
Yeah. Get out of my way, I'm fucking Q.
Rest in peace. Bond just goes into speed all the time. Why can't I? God damn it. But actually, the scene I'm going to go for is from The Spy Who Loved Me, the opening sequence where we have him skiing, being chased down the side of a cliff by bad guys. And
the Union Jack flag.
The Union Jack flag, baby. Yeah. What a cool stunt. Where we see that it's actually a combination of the stunt people who pull that gag off. And it's that moment when you see that he's in this yellow and red kind of trimmed outfit, and he just goes right off the edge, and the soundtrack just
cuts
quietens.
Soaked, doesn't it? Goes completely
quietly,
soaked.
And we're watching him, and he feels like we're tracking him forever and ever and ever and ever. And those skis are kind of flapping around the place. And then all of a sudden he pulls the cord and the Union Jack flag billows out, the score erupts.
Kicks in, yeah.
A part of my ancestry turns in their grave. You know, my ancestors.
Clang-a-lang-a-lang-a-lang-a-lang-a-lang-a-lang-a-lang-a-lang-a-lang. Nobody does it better. And I'm a naked woman in silhouette with a gun, spinning round. Makes me feel sad for the rest. Nobody does it. Oh, bit of nipple.
But I feel like that wasn't that the second Roger Moore Bond?
Oh, no, that's well down the road. That was like his fourth, at least.
Oh, was it?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Live and Let Die, then...
Live and Let the Man with the Golden Gun. Oh, maybe it's the third one. So it's maybe That's Why You Love Me. Then it was for Your Eyes Only.
I feel like if anyone had any doubts about Roger Moore's Bond at that stage, they were blown away by that one image.
Yeah.
It's
an iconic...
He's Bond now.
Yeah, it's an iconic moment from the entire Bond franchise.
It's like Jerry Halliwell walking down the Brit stage in... The Union Jack dress. Makes you want to stand up and salute and say, God bless the Queen.
But what I want to highlight, right, is it's so important that we, in every Bond film, that you do have these staples. Like, you do need those grounding relationships. Relationships are really important. That Bond and Moneypenny, I feel that Bond and Moneypenny should always have a kind of a flirtation going on. It doesn't have to be sexist. It's just there has to be this chemistry. And it's just ever...
Right, okay.
I feel it needs to be there.
Yes, and it was there in... So this is one thing that stood out to me. Moneypenny and M were very fond of Bond throughout all of the Connery era. But then when Roger Moore came along in The Spy Who... was it The Man with the Golden Gun? Maybe it was that one.
That's his second one.
Yeah, it was his second film. They were very curt and abrupt to him.
Mm-hmm.
And Moneypenny didn't like him. And I thought, what's gone on here? What's changed? And I don't know if there was something that happened in Live and Let Die, because I didn't revisit that one because I had seen that one before, that sort of signified the change there. But then they get back to normal again.
I just think they might have been experimenting there. Sometimes they just try little tweaks on it. But I think I think those relationships are so important because that's his family. That's Bond's family. And I think it's so integral.
Can I mention one thing, though, about Bond as well, which is sort of like you talk about the sort of the familiarity between the cast of characters, and Bond is almost like drag and dropped into them, and he's the different element, and then you bring in different henchmen, different Bond girls, what have you.
Yeah.
But there are certain tropes of a Bond film that sort of have held true throughout all of the films up until No Time to Die, which sort of broke formula entirely. But it's that you'll have a Bond villain who's got some sort of perversion about himself or disability. There's something about him which is not, he's not a rival to Bond. He's not on Bond's level, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. You know, you think of the man with the golden gun, he's got a third nipple for some reason, or Blofeld is scarred, or they've all got something about him which just feels...
Dr. No has got he's got these metal hands. Yeah.
Plastic hands.
Yeah.
They didn't look metal to me.
Yeah.
And then with the Bond girls, Bond always sleeps with both of them. There might be three of them, but he'll sleep with two of them anyway. Mm-hmm. One of them he'll convert, and the other one will get killed because of sleeping with him. And you see it again and again and again throughout all of the Bond films. And then, of course, when you get to Daniel Craig, they sort of play with that a little bit more. But yeah, that's also something which happens a lot. You might have your Bond song, you might have your, you know, your gadgets, your car that can do something spectacular, but you'll also have two Bond girls, you'll sleep with both of them, and one of them will die.
That's so true. It has actually in any film I'm trying to imagine. No, I think that happens nearly all of them. It's so true. It
doesn't happen in No Time to Die, though, because he doesn't sleep with anybody, really.
Okay, right. I'm just trying to remember. Yeah, okay. Well, that was the one that really deviated from the formula in many ways.
Did. Sucked.
So I need to get to my final, my favorite Bond. And of course, my favorite Bond is Sean.
I admire your luck, Mr.
Bond. James Bond.
Or Thomas, as his actual original birth name was.
I didn't know that. Oh my God.
There you go.
Do you know how much Sean Connery was paid for Dr. No?
$25,000.
You're not far off, actually. Less, 17. He got paid $17,000 for Dr. Yeah. No. Like compared to what he was getting paid for.
Can I tell you something else about his pay?
Go on.
When he came back to do Diamonds Are Forever, he got paid $1.25 million, I think it was.
Right.
And he took that money and he opened a school for education in Scotland.
No way.
Yeah.
What a legend.
So fair play to him.
What a legend. Oh my God. Listen, Connery, when Connery first came into the role, it's as if when we see him for the first time in Dr. No at that casino table, which, as I mentioned in the best character intro, he feels fully formed. He feels like, Jesus, this guy, there was no shaping this needs to happen to this character. It's already fully formed. But in actual fact, how we got to that point was we had Ian Fleming's source material, but Connery wasn't comfortable at all wearing suits or smoking cigars or drinking fancy cocktails. He was a rough lad from Scotland. Like, you know, he'd won some, you know, strength competitions or whatever it was. And the director was Terence Young. Terence Young, who was actually originally Irish. No, there we go. But Terence Young was basically Bond in real life by pure chance. He's a guy who had been through the war. He was a war veteran, but he was slick and dapper and cultured and sophisticated. And he had this lad thrown at him that would have been cast, Sean Connery, who was kind of like well down the list of lads they wanted in the role, who didn't really know his way around a suit. Terence Young helped craft Sean Connery into this suave, stylish, sophisticated James Bond that appeared on set, you know, in that first scene in Dr. No. So a huge credit has to be given to Terence Young for the James Bond that we know and Connery's successful tenure in the role. What was your experience watching all those films? So you watched all those films in the last few days.
Yeah. So as I said, I never went back and revisited any of them. They were never on telly. I didn't have the box sets. I didn't sort of have a good enough reason to sort of go back. And I knew all the big iconography moments from the films, you know, Pussy Galore and Odd Job and Rosa Klebb, all those kind of sort of like, when I do lists on TV, you'd see all these great sequences. But watching them in sequence, that run of films, Connery had the best run of all of them. And those first five are fucking brilliant. They're great adventure films. Mm-hmm. The set design, oh my God. When we got to You Only Live Twice and Ken Adams' set there in the volcano, mm-hmm. I thought, all right, that's where Scorpio's set is from in The Simpsons.
Yeah.
It was unbelievable. And looking up online, they actually built that.
They fucking did. It's built a million to build it. It was the biggest set ever constructed up to that point. Absolutely the biggest set.
It was jaw-dropping.
Yeah.
None of the films, even Craig's films, hold a candle to the scale and the majesty of the Connery films.
Look, even from Dr. No, Ken Adam was involved. He was the art director and set designer. He was involved from Dr. No early on. And you can see in his limited budget, his artistry in the Dr. No set design. This very, very stylized, sharp edge, sharp angles and spaces. And
Big spaces.
And he used volume. He used depth in all those scenes. He continues to work on the sets for 20 years, I'm pretty sure, or more.
See, this is the thing, because then I looked up, when I watched Diamonds Are Forever, I thought it had gone away from glamour and it had become slightly gaudy. And mm-hmm. I thought they must have changed production designers here. But no, he did that one as well. So I'm not sure. Maybe it's under the direction of whoever was in charge or whether it was a cost thing, but...
I do wonder about cost. I do wonder if it's about cost, Kevin, in Diamonds Are Forever. But what he did in those first six films is phenomenal, really. And also in the Roger Moore era, he did a couple of great sets in the Roger Moore era as well. I really liked his work. And
can I say though, just before you get into what you're going to say about Sean Connery, that my favorite Bond film of all of the Bond films, mm-hmm. it's neck and neck between Skyfall and Goldfinger.
Oh, wow. Okay, go on.
Yeah, I thought Goldfinger was gorgeous to look at. Like, You Only Live Twice as well. And that's a great one as well. Maybe that's in my top three. But what I loved about Goldfinger was the plot of the villain. Mm-hmm. I didn't expect where it was going. And I can almost imagine that the writers of Die Hard and the director of Die Hard, John McTiernan, what have you, probably said we should do something like Goldfinger, which is that you think... This guy is going in to heist the gold, but it's actually not. There's a twist to it. He's going to irradiate the gold so that it's useless. They can't go near it. And I thought, that is genius. That's a great villain's plot.
Yeah.
And yeah, I just wanted to give a shout out to Goldfinger because, as I said, I'm probably teaching people to suck eggs here and they're like going, yeah, of course, Kevin, we all know Goldfinger is a good film. Fucking hell. But for me, it was like, no, actually, lads, if you haven't gone back and revisited these films like myself, you don't need a podcast to do it. Go back and watch them. You will actually get a kick out of them. They're great.
Those first five, watch them and be thrilled. My favorite Connery film, my favorite Bond film, and I actually rewatched it just to kind of confirm for myself, am I sure that this is my favorite Bond film? Because not many people have this as their favorite Bond film. But my favorite Bond film is You Only Live Twice. I think
it is a great film, though.
For me, it's the culmination of everything that's been built up for before. It's not like any of the rest of them are weaker. I'm the same as you. I could interchange them maybe tomorrow. I could swap them around. But I love the story of You Only Live Twice. It starts off in space. First of all, I love that. And astronauts being kidnapped from space and taken back to Earth. It's fantastic.
And it looks a decade ahead of its time.
Fuck yeah. It just came out before 2001. It looks class. It really does. And we have Bond on the pursuit of figuring out what the fuck happened. Because what's happening is that Russia is blaming America and America's blaming Russia. Nuclear Armageddon is about to happen, and it's Bond's job to figure out what the fuck has happened. So he goes to Japan. I love it.
But listen, this is one of the things I love about Bond, and I know we've probably just slightly touched on it, but it's the locations, both the sets and the actual the globe trotting of Bond.
Oh, that's so important. It's that feeling of visiting these amazing locations that back then people definitely didn't have the means to be able to go to Japan and see what Japan was like. So they would go and watch a Bond film. and experience.
Yeah, watch Bond watching sumo wrestling.
There we go. Which they actually shot for real. And fucking hell, it looks class. And some of the action sequences are audacious in this film. It goes from, like, you know, it goes from the bad guys who are chasing Bond in their black car get picked up by a helicopter, one of those double-bladed helicopters that's pick it up with a magnet and drop them out to sea. Like, how audacious is it? But it never looks goofy. It never looks cheap. This is the big thing.
That doesn't slip in until, as I said, Diamonds Are Forever.
Never looks cheap. And you know the Little Nelly. So Q's gadget in this is called the Little Nelly, which is this one-man helicopter.
Copter thing, yeah.
So when they were shooting that, that was actually a guy invented that, and they saw it on TV and went, Jesus, we want that for the next Bond movie. And so he came along and did it. So they were shooting that up in the sky and around Japan. And one of the fucking camera guys got his foot chopped off by a helicopter.
Jesus.
Yeah, yeah. But he kept on going, which is...
That's why you like the film, isn't it?
No, not, that's not
actually
what
it, were maimed making it.
Well, maybe.
That's what I want. I want real stunts. I want people maimed, killed. That's what I want in the Bond film. None of your CGI fucking tsunamis.
Again, Kevin, you're talking about sets. That epicenter, that big set at the end where...
I think that set is better than Star Wars. Oh. It's better than Superman. It's better than it. It is like just jaw dropping.
Not
the
only
whole
that
end sequence.
The film has got ninjas. It's got ninjas, cool fucking ninjas throwing stars with samurai swords. We've got a battle between ninjas and Spectre agents in the end. It's fucking class. Them the shot of them coming down, you know, the on the ropes. Fucking love it. But Kevin, I think I've gone on so long. Let me just say, I love this film.
And love is a stranger who'll beckon you on. Don't think of the danger, or the stranger is gone.
My best bit, and this is my best Bond bit in the entire franchise, and it came out of nowhere. And when I saw it, I got chills, and I went, this is the moment. This is the moment that I love. And the moment happened when Bond and Kissy Suzuki go to the dockyards in Japan and they're looking for a ship, but they find themselves surrounded, slowly surrounded by bad guys. They're dockyard workers, but they're actually sinister Spectre agents. Bond and Kissy kind of escape, and Bond takes out his Walter PPK and shoots a couple of them. But what I love is the music, the John Barry score, doesn't go thrilling and exciting. It slowly builds.
Get out of here. Contact Tanaka.
I'm not leaving you.
Tell him to keep that ship shadowed wherever she goes.
Yasna!
Go now.
And Bond gets Kissy out of the way, and Bond lures the guys to follow him up these flight of stairs, and he bursts out onto a rooftop, and the music is building more and more and more. But no matter what, no matter how many guys are approaching, Bond is still in control. And what we have on the rooftop is this shot. This film was shot by Freddie Young, by the way, who shot fucking David Lean's films. It's an amazing cinematographer. We have a helicopter shot, and fucking John Barry's score builds, and we see Bond running across the rooftops with more and more bad guys chasing after him, and he fucking looks cool as shit, and he's just taking them all on, kicking a couple of guys down to the ground. And I swear to God, if the film ended right there, and if I was ever to make a Bond film, I would have him ending on a shot like this, of a helicopter pullout shot of him being swarmed by bad guys. But still, we know that this fucking Bond is going to get out of it some way, somehow. He might get the shit kicked out of him, but no matter what, he will come out of it unfazed and cool as fuck.
That's the British bulldog spirit, man.
Oh, fucking hell. My Irish ancestors will absolutely appreciate that.
That's why they dominated the whole world. They're just better than us.
But I love that moment, that shot, that sense. It gave me tingles watching it again together. I went, that's my Bond moment. That's Bond moment. Bond takes on the bad guys.
It is fucking class, that film. Definitely. Yeah.
So
wait, Will, before you move on, we didn't talk about Bond songs. And I just want to ask, because you've ranked all the Bonds.
Oh, shit.
What is, first of all, what are your, give me your top three Bond films, just for now.
Just for now. At the top, I can say is, well, I kind of have to re-rank in my head. I'm going to say You Only Live Twice is at the top. Okay. I think I would nearly put Casino Royale up there with it.
Okay.
And I'll put another Connery there besides, like maybe Goldfinger.
Yeah, and I'm going to go Goldfinger, You Only Live Twice, and Skyfall.
Ah.
Those are my three, yeah.
So similar rankings, similar rankings.
And favorite Bond songs?
Shit, I love all the 80s ones.
I love A View to a Kill.
Yeah.
The Duran Duran one I think is fucking class.
Yeah.
But the one that stands out to me and sort of, I have a sense memory of it. I can remember just being up at my nan's and it's like Saturday morning when they would show the Top of the Pops type shows of all the new music videos. Mm-hmm. And the Bono song for GoldenEye with Tina Turner.
Yeah, it's class.
I fucking love that yeah. song. I think it's great. Those yeah. are my two favorites. Sorry, Shirley Bassey.
There are very few Bond films that have poor Bond songs. Like, you know, they're so class. Like, there's very few of them that, you know, maybe there was the one for Quantum of Solace or something like that. Wasn't that great? But the Adele one is amazing. The Tom Jones one.
And the last thing I'll say, just as an observation, is that I don't think that Connery's Bond is as sexist as I thought he would have been. That I think the films are a little bit more sexist than the character is. So I thought that he came out of it quite well in my eyes because I expected it to be a lot more misogynistic than it was.
Yeah, well, they're pretty...
playful.
They're playful. They're pretty misogynistic for the time. There's a lot of the imperialist stuff is kind of like the racism is a little bit there. And anyway, but again...
Oh yeah, there's a moment where he says like, fetch my shoes to the henchman, the black guy on the island.
Yeah.
And I thought that's a bit insensitive. But I loved when he's got Honey Rider and he keeps saying like, listen, honey... It's a bit Blackadder-ish.
But what I liked about what Phoebe Waller-Bridge said, who was one of the writers on the new one, she said, look, it's fine having the character be sexist as long as the film isn't sexist. Like, you know...
Yeah, so that's where I think the originals sort of fall down in certain regard.
Yeah, and I think going forward, you can still have Bond being a sexist big. You can still have sexiness in the film. And I think sexiness is so important in Bond. And I hope going forward that they re-embrace that they remember that, you know, beauty and sex appeal is a big aspect of the Bond franchise, especially if you look at the latter day Roger Moore's. Oh, hello, that leathery skin in a bed waiting for a young 20.
With Mayday.
With Mayday. Kevin, we have finished Bond's best Bond scene. I am going to spin the wheel for your next topic and I am spinning. What are you hoping for, Kev?
Something with few films to watch. That's been something that has surprised me. This season is all of the films we got to watch.
Yeah, we've watched a lot of films. And your topic for this week, I don't know if you're going to laugh or cry, it's best disaster scene.
I am really happy with that, actually. That is actually, that's good. That's genuinely a good one. Okay.
Great.
Disaster movie scene, obviously.
Yes, yes, not a disaster scene.
All Roland Emmerich films.
That's basically the entire franchise done right there. Right, yeah. We have another episode in the can. Thank you, Kevin.
Good luck editing it.
I know. And also, thank you, listeners, for listening. Please like and review us on whatever podcast platform you use. And
we have over 20-odd extra podcasts, bonus podcasts, available for anyone that wants to be a patron of the show. For the price of a pint, you can be a subscriber. And we put out mini-episodes, which are about half an hour each, pretty regularly, almost every week. And we do extra commentaries, and we have guests and what and the like and all that kind of stuff. And we love doing them. We're going to keep doing them. So jump on in and get involved. And thank you to our Patreon backers who are listening.
Love you.
Love you.
Kevin and Patreon backers. All right. Good luck.
I love that moment actually with a code word that Moneypenny gave Bond was to say, I love you.
I love you.
Take care, everyone. Disaster movies. I'm looking forward to that, actually.
The Best Bits podcast is produced by Will and Kevin.
All audio clips and music heard in this episode is the intellectual property of the respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended.
If you enjoyed this episode, please like, share, subscribe, rate, review, all that good stuff.
If you have any notes, comments, scene suggestions, or just want to get in touch with us, email us at bestbitspodcast@gmail.com.
Wait a second there. David Arnold didn't do the music for GoldenEye. It was Eric Serra. And here is a clip from the lad's latest Mini Bits bonus show. The full episode, plus 100 more, are available on their Patreon.
Play dumb and stupid.
Two fun guys.
Kevin and Will.
Kevin and Will.
So what's the story, Kevin? It's been a minute.
It's been a minute. You've got news. Tell us your news. Hello, everybody. This is Kevin, and I'm joined by Will, and this is Mini Bit 72, just in case we didn't say so. I wonder what theme tune I'll put at the beginning of this. I've recorded so many of them. I usually just take my pick when I go for the I go for the egotistical one, or the epic one, or the 80s synthwave one, or the cowboy and western one. We'll see. Depends on the mood of this Mini Bits.
Okay. I'm looking forward to hearing which one it is. I'm curious because you said to me, you've got news.
Yeah.
And I'm like going, what fucking news do I have?
You nearly died during the week. That is pretty monumental.
There it is. There's me dying right there on mic. Yeah, I almost died.
Because of the Discord.
It was the Discord, yeah. It was the Discord's fault.
What happened? Tell me what happened.
Yeah.
Because we haven't actually spoken in about 3 weeks.
Yeah.
Since the Irish recording, the Irish episode recording, we haven't been on mic together. Do you want to talk about this? We can cut it out if you don't want to.
I do want it to be at the front of, you know, the way we have this, you know, the tag.
We'll save that.
So I'll talk about it later. I'll talk about it later in the episode. You know, we can talk about something else, but I'm quite happy to talk about it later for our special people.
Okay. Well, listen. I saw these questions on TikTok during the last few weeks, and I thought, those are good questions. I'm going to make a note of them. I'm going to ask Will some of them. So I've got about five of them here. They're quite philosophical.
Okay.
And maybe if I ask you one as the teaser of this episode, and then we can pepper out the other one. Right. See how you get on.
Okay.
So give me from one to five, a number from one to five.
Go. Let's go five. Let's go on five.
Question five. If you could, would you rather spend a day with your younger self or your older self? Take your time.
No.
It's live radio.
This is a Back to the Future question.
Right? Is it?
Am I talking to my older self and my older self going, hey kid, bet on the socks?
Would you sooner meet up with your older self and get the wisdom of your older self to say to you what you probably need to hear now, which is get a shift on, get a wiggle on? Or would you sooner go back to your younger self and say, listen, that thing that you're worried about, or that thing that you don't do and you should have done, you know, give him a pointer or some sort of a steer. So it's whether you want
is
the steer
it going to work
or do you
out?
Want to give your younger self a steer. Forgetting about the ramifications and the consequences. Forget all the sort of the grandfather paradox for those that don't know what the grandfather paradox is. Go back to our time travel episode.
Yeah. All right. I think I'll go back to my younger self, right? And I'll say, you know, I'll ask my younger self, come here, what's the big worry? What are you worried about? And
you should know that.
Well, I'm
don't
going to
you
ask,
remember what you're worried about?
But the specific thing, because I worry about so many things. You know, we all worry about various different things, you know, from, you know.
Losing your Spider-Man shoes.
Yes. I'm going to go, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. Because guess what? Next week, you're going to have Batman. You're going to have Batman willies.
Also,
right, in
the future, there's a thing called a podcast. And you'll be able to tell people what happened to your Spider-Man shoes on the podcast.
Exactly. It's all the bad shit that's happening to you will be, it's filling you up and it will be good content. That's all it is. All that embarrassing stuff that you do is going to be all right as long as you don't be too much of a prick and just stay the course. That's kind of it.
I'd be the opposite.
No, I think I would have a nice little sit down.
You'd have what? A nice shit?
I'd have a nice sit down and a nice little chat with myself. That's what I would do. How would you do? You're saying you would do the opposite.
I'd do the opposite. I'd want to speak to my future self because I can enact whatever they tell me. So I can, you know, live in the moment. Mm-hmm. So I'd like to know, I'd like foresight. Tell me what is coming towards me or what I need to be aware of. And I will make the change now because I can. Going back to my younger self, I would just be unburdening my younger self. And then, I don't know, hoping that would change the course of my life. But I'm very happy with my life. I think everything's turned out fantastic. So I wouldn't want to risk change anything. So, yeah.
Honestly, that was my first thought as well. I was like, going, yeah, I want all the information my older self can give me. And but I was like, I'll go back and I'll kind of help my younger self out a little bit.
When you hit 65, prostate is going to blow up like a basketball.
Yeah. I didn't want to talk to my older self because what if my oldest self is 37? You know, I only live, you know, another 2 years. I'm obviously by saying that I'm implying I'm 35 right now.
I was going to say, I was like getting confused there.
Yeah. Yeah, that's why I said I needed to put some clarity on that one. I would be afraid for my older self to come back and my older self go come back and I see the state of him and I go, oh shit, just one look at my older self and go, oh fuck no.
Listen, I just had the camera angled wrong there when I turned on the webcam here and that's already rattled me. I'm like, oh God.
You should never have the camera pointed at your balls, Kevin. Never, ever, ever, ever.
That's how I make a living. $5.99 a month. Well, listen, that'll do as a teaser.
Yes, go on.
Thank you to everybody that's listened to the latest episode, which we haven't recorded yet, and I hope it was a good episode because I have no fucking clue what I'm going to talk about on that episode. But we've already done it now because you've heard us talking about it. But also, this might be one of the random episodes. So, this is the Patreon. We do the mini bits. Come along. They're great episodes. We're going to keep talking, though. See ya.
Fuck them. Yeah, fuck that.
Fuck that.
Bye.